Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Jacob Zen, as well as an updated primary sources segment and hashtag social media. Jacob is an analyst of African and Eurasian affairs for the Jamestown Foundation.
Jacob and I talked about all things Wilayat Gharb Ifriqiya, the group known in the media as Boko Haram, from its history to its international connections, its joining of the Islamic State, as well as its recent operations in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon.
Jacob has traveled extensively in West Africa, including northern Nigeria, and he speaks Arabic and Hausa. This episode features a discussion on primary sources covering the time period of July 18th through August 1st. And to start us off, Aaron, why don't you tell us about primary source material related to Jabhat al-Nusra that's come out during that time period?
There wasn't any particular theme necessarily for Jabhat al-Nusra, but a bunch of various types of releases that I found interesting. One of them was on July 18th, where they opened up a distribution center for free clothing to the needy during the end of Ramadan in Latakia province. And they're showing off providing it to these types of individuals. About 10 days later then, Jabhat al-Nusra's top Sharia official, Dr. Sami al-Uraidi, released a missive sort of looking at different excerpts in Abu Musab al-Suri's works previously on the Islamist uprising in Syria in the 1980s, which Uraidi describes as the first Syrian revolution, and essentially saying that it's relevant to what's going on now, in particular highlighting how jihadi groups need to be self-sufficient and not relying on funding or support externally. Otherwise, their decision makings might be corrupted or influenced against their own interests. And he cautions against alliances with secular groups. And he warns essentially that this could lead to allying with the West then, specifically saying the enemy of yesterday cannot be the ally of the future. Then a couple of days after that, everybody, I guess, has opinion about the Iran nuclear agreement since Jabhat al-Nusra put out a video asking residents in Aleppo about it. In particular, these residents were critical of it, saying that it is against Muslims and Islam and it represents a broader problem of worldwide persecution against Sunni Muslims and is part of a conspiracy between the United States, Russia, and the Shia. And the final thing that Jabhat al-Nusra put out was on July 31st, and this was a statement about the Division 30, essentially the group of individuals that the U.S. had been involved with to train and equip who were then put back into Syria and were going to fight against the Islamic State. But after this occurred, Jabhat al-Nusra arrested a number of individuals within this grouping. And in the video message, they're essentially describing who this group was and how Jabhat al-Nusra suspects them of truly aiming to fight them and other sympathetic groups within their milieu as part of the war on terror, and it's not just against the Islamic State, and therefore they're coordinating with American planes, and that essentially they're calling those within Division 30 that have not been arrested yet or captured to leave this project and return to the front lines against the Assad regime.
And what have you seen recently related to the Islamic State and their governance efforts?
The Islamic State has been continuing to do a number of things related to governance, but in terms of official releases and video messages, there is one in particular that seemed unique during this time period on July 18th, where they're talking about the responsibility of their Bureau of Dawah and mosques, where they highlight it's about correcting religious beliefs of the people and encouraging them to jihad, and highlighting how they've distributed religious literature and trained people to take religious teachings into their own villages, and having putting on special classes for women, for Kurds and Turkmen in their own specific languages, and young people as well. They're also highlighting that this office is involved with establishing different Islamic libraries, holding Quranic competitions. And the individuals that's talking about this in the video describes the work of the mosques department, which includes classifying mosques, determining their needs, and assigning them imams. Their work also includes destroying architectural bid'ah, or innovation as they say it, which would include the destruction of shrines and graves, as well as repairing and improving established mosques.
Can you tell us about the videos the Islamic State put out related to Eid al-Fitr?
Between July 19th and July 25th, the Islamic State put out a number of different releases related to Eid al-Fitr and the territories they control. For example, in al-Raqqa province, Fallujah, in Wilayat Dijla, in Nineveh, Wilayat al-Khair, also known as Deir ez-Zor region, as well as the Aleppo area. And they even put out one related to what was going on in their Wilayat Gharbi Firqiya, or northern Nigeria. There are a number of key scenes or themes that they discuss in all these videos, which included children playing in fairground rides and eating sweets, the distribution of gifts to kids, the Islamic State running a bunch of different games and contests for children, people buying ice cream at different shops. They also highlighted how when they are interviewing residents in these areas, the peaceful atmosphere, security, and happiness that prevailed, and the future hopes that they had with in the territory going forward. And then the last aspect of it, they showed prayers and sermons at the mosques, as well as highlighting that individuals were finally allowed to celebrate the full and true rituals related to Eid properly now that they lived under the caliphate.
And can you tell us about the AQAP video that was released towards the end of July?
The video was of Nasr al-Wahashi, clearly recorded prior to his death, about the understanding the implementation of Sharia and the spirit and letter related to it. And he was arguing that the implementation of Sharia should not be confined to policing relatively minor violations, such as women wearing the hijab incorrectly in the streets, but rather should encompass broader Islamic beliefs and practices, such as adherence to monotheism and the practices of jihad, prayer, zakat, and other things. And one could argue that this is an indirect slight at the Islamic State, since he's essentially saying that they're nitpicking people for small things that doesn't necessarily have to have large penalties, but in fact, you really just try and explain to people what they're doing and then from there learn from it and hopefully then follow the true path instead of providing corporal or criminal punishments to individuals.
There have been numerous releases related to the Islamic State and their dawah efforts. Can you tell us more about those?
Yeah, so one of the things that the Islamic State does when they talk to people in the streets in different areas of territories that they control is that they pass out these different leaflets of information related to what their ideology is and what they're trying to do, as well as background information. And starting during this time period, they pushed out on their official media dissemination accounts on Twitter the actual content from this literature, even though it had unofficially been, you know, online for a few prior months before that. And they put out a number of them, which included one on July 20th about their creed and methodology, essentially talking about the Islamic State's belief in the oneness of God, his omnipotence, and his creation of the world, in the Prophet Muhammad and all their prophets and the angels, in the Quran is the word of God, and the beliefs in God's absolute judgment, the importance of faith and works, and the definition of faith as words and deeds and intent, as well as the issue of takfir, or calling somebody an unbeliever, and state that ISIS does not declare anyone an infidel who does not deserve it, and that such a ruling must satisfy certain conditions. And then finally, that jihad is mandatory, but the blood and property of Muslims is sacrosanct. A day later, the Islamic State put out one about the provisions of the bay'ah, or pledge of allegiance to the caliphate, in particular Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, essentially saying that those that do not swear allegiance to the caliph will die in ignorance or jahiliyyah. and explains that attacking an unjust Muslim leader is always forbidden, and that it's incumbent to obey a leader who has achieved power by force, and that a leader must always be obeyed unless he dies or suffers a serious deficiency in his body or in his religion, and that Muslims can only have one leader at any one time, and that breaking such an oath is a very serious offense. And then they go on to explain what the oath specifically means, essentially arguing that in Sharia terms, it's kind of a social contract between a leader who promises to rule justly and his subjects who promise to obey him. A couple of days later, on July 23rd, they further put out one of their Dawah pamphlets related to the issue of Bay'ah, specific to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Providing information about his life, qualifications, his career, as well as his specific genealogy stretching back to Muhammad's tribe, Quraysh. It then discusses his religious studies and extent of his knowledge and explaining the parallels between him and one of the great Sunni leaders such as Umar bin Khattab, one of the original caliphs. It also describes his rise to power and how he became the leader of the Islamic State of Iraq and the expansion from that to Syria as well. And then there is also a section in this pamphlet discussing accusations and responses in which the author essentially rebuts various charges against Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, highlighting that he does not possess necessarily qualities for the imamate and whether he can be caliph when not everyone is agreeing to pledge bay'ah to him. And it concludes by talking about an injunction for all those fighting in the way of God to unite and pledge allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. A few days after that, on July 26th, they put out a specific Dawah pamphlet related to the legality of the demolition of graves or tombs. In particular, this usually targets those that are Shiites or Sufis. And they highlight that tombs are devious and idolatrous and that ISIS has been working to remove them and that these types of entities or structures are a way to make money out of religion and are propped up by false teachings and errant scholars. But they do highlight that this doesn't mean that the memory of previous generations should not be honored, just that there should not be worshiping of them or innovations concerning their graves, such as building mosques over them. And the final one in this time period that they put out was specifically about the evidence for the obligation of women to cover their faces. They define the hijab according to Sharia that a woman cannot be seen by any man whom it may be permissible for her to marry, i.e. non-relatives, and therefore if she has to leave the house, no part of her must be showing. Also in this leaflet, it states that even if religion and Sharia did not prescribe hijab dress, common sense would dictate it because no reasonable man would want a stranger seeing his wife's face. Therefore, hijab must be enforced by women and men with support of the Hizba police. Women must not leave their homes also except when strictly necessary, and that men should ensure that homes are properly constructed so that no one can see in from the outside.
And of course, we also have some anti-Islamic State releases. Can you tell me about those?
So on July 29th, Abu Qatada al-Filistini put out an open letter to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, essentially in relation to the one-year anniversary of the declaration of the caliphate. Abu Qatada reiterated a bunch of his previous criticisms of al-Baghdadi's caliphate that was established without proper consultation, that is following the path of the Kharijites, and that it kills those who are fighting in the way of God. But then it asks whether al-Baghdadi has paused or reflected over the past year since his caliphate was announced, and wondering whether it had been of good or of evil. And then he essentially talks about how all the caliphate truly has done is abduct women and kill the so-called mujahideen and then brag about it in their videos and tweets online. And that Abu Qatada highlights that Baghdadi needs to remember those who came before him in the Iraq jihad and that he owes everything to those individuals. And he then concludes by predicting the downfall of this caliphate, which he highlights rules through fear and not love.
And finally, what groups have we seen releasing martyrdom statements and condolences regarding the death of Mullah Omar?
Interestingly, so far, we haven't seen any major groups putting out statements in relation to Mullah Omar's death. In fact, we've seen them from groups like Ajnad al-Kaukaz, Ansar al-Furqan, Harakat Ahrar al-Sham al-Islamiyya, Jaish Muhammad fi Bilad al-Sham, Jabhat Ansar al-Din, and Hizbul Islami al-Turkestani fi Bilad al-Sham. All are smaller groups or non, you know, heavy hitters within the jihadi scene. So we'll see what happens. I imagine that different branches of al-Qaeda, including its general command, will eventually put something out, but maybe they'll have a special video instead of just a statement, since Mullah Omar and the Taliban have been so integral in some ways in the development of al-Qaeda in the late 1990s and allowing it to sort of spread its wings and ability to have a safe haven to, you know, plan and conduct the different types of operations and terrorist attacks it did from 1998 through, you know, 2005 in terms of their larger scale attacks. Thanks for coming onto the show today, Jacob. You're live from Chad right now, actually.
That's right. And thanks for having me. I'm always glad to discuss with you.
So today I wanted to talk with you a little bit about what's called nowadays Wilayat Gharbi Frikiya, though still popularly called Boko Haram by most people. Could you, before we get into some of the issues that are more relevant to what's going on now, could you provide sort of maybe a 5-minute background quickly on the history of Boko Haram up until most recently?
Sure, I'll be glad to. The 5-minute scoop on the group known as Boko Haram can start basically with the years 2002 to 2009, when it was an above ground preaching group, similar to what I think some of these Ansar al-Sharia groups were like in North Africa and even Yemen, trying to preach for an Islamic state in Nigeria, and in particular deviating from mainstream Salafist groups on the issue of Western education, saying any form of Western education that contradicts the Quran in any way should be completely banned. And the second issue where they deviated from mainstream Salafist preaching was on service in government, where the then Boko Haram leader, Muhammad Yusuf, said that if you serve in the Nigerian government, you're an apostate and you're no longer a Muslim and so forth. Now, this type of ideology ended up clashing with not only mainstream Salafist groups, but also with the Nigerian government. And after a series of low-level skirmishes in July 2009, it came to sort of a climax, and the government and the Boko Haram movement got into a series of 4 days of clashes, and tons of Boko Haram members, up to 1,000, were killed or injured, and several dozen members of the security forces were also killed or injured. But after that, the Boko Haram members, especially those who came from Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, because those three countries border Borno State, where Boko Haram was based, they fled back into the border region. They spent a year sort of recovering from the loss of men and the destruction of their group and their mosques and so forth. And in 2010, they came back in July 2009, now under the ostensible leadership of Abu Bakr Shekau, who was the deputy of the founder, Muhammad Yusuf, and he declared a jihad against Nigeria and the United States. So since 2010, there's been the violent conflict, which has evolved, in particular because Boko Haram, the more local group based in Borno State, has interacted heavily with the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb trained militants, and more recently now with the Islamic State militants. And this has really enhanced its operational capacity in terms of kidnappings, raids on military barracks, and IEDs. And now it's a very sophisticated militant group. And also it's developed its propaganda slightly under AQIM militants, but much more under the influence of the Islamic state within the past half year. So now it has a whole professional media apparatus that it coordinates with the Islamic State. It has gradually seeped into the border regions of Cameroon, Niger, and Chad, including with the recent suicide bombings at the Chad police headquarters and police academy and in a market. And that is sort of one of the latest trends, the extent to which it'll shift into the border regions. Its logistics routes already run straight through Chad and Cameroon, so that's not anything new. It's more of the level of attacks. And the Pledge of Allegiance, or Bayat, from Shekau to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is, of course, probably the main point of Boko Haram this year, and that will likely affect its trajectory in future years. So I'll stop at that. I hope that provides a general overview, but we can certainly delve deeper into this throughout our discussion.
Yeah, most definitely. And there will be some more questions in a little bit specifically on some of these points. But before we get to that, one of the things that has been interesting is that the group itself has never actually called itself Boko Haram. Originally, it was Jamaat Ahl Sunnah Lil Dawah Wal Jihad. And then, of course, after the pledge to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, it turned into Wilayat Gharbi Afriqiya. Can you talk a little bit about this term Boko Haram, sort of what the background of it, what it means? Why did it become associated with this organization, even if it didn't use it itself?
Certainly. As I mentioned, when Boko Haram was an above-ground preaching group from 2002 to 2009, one of its core ideologies was that there's a ban on all types of Western education. And the term Boko Haram can translate to Western education is haram or forbidden. Boko can either translate to book or literature, referring to Western literature, or it can refer more broadly to magic, the types of things that would be haram in Islam, such as superstitions, and more broadly refers to Western education. So when Muhammad Yusuf, the founder, was preaching his ideology in the mid-2000s, people would refer to him and his group by this moniker Boko Haram, meaning these are the guys that are preaching that Boko is haram. However, before 2009, before Yusuf was killed in those clashes that I discussed, Yusuf's followers didn't really have a name per se. Some people might call them the Yusufiya, or the people of Yusuf. Some people might call them Ahl Sunnah. Or some people might just call them, you know, that group. They really didn't have a formalized name in any way, shape, or form. It was only in 2010 when Shekau, the former deputy of Yusuf, emerged as the new leader, that he said, our name is Jamaat Ahl Sunnah Lidawat Wal Jihad, the Sunni Muslim preaching group for preaching and jihad. And that's been their name from 2010 until 2015. Time and time again, Shekau has said, if you call us Boko Haram, we will kill you. We don't like that name. However, the name has stuck because people still view them by that name, Boko Haram. People also used to call them Nigerian Taliban or Black Taliban, by the way, because they were influenced by the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, as well as Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood like Hassan al-Banna and Sayyid Qutb, and deeper by Ibn Taymiyyah. So they also had that moniker, I should mention. So they've been called Jamaat Ahl Sunnah Lidawati Wal Jihad. It's incredibly difficult to into an acronym for English. It's incredibly difficult to shorten in Arabic in any way. So that's also been one reason why the media has probably stuck to Boko Haram. Now we'll see what happens, that they don't call themselves Jamaat Ahl Sunnah Lidawati Jihad anymore, but they call themselves Wilayah Gharb Afriqiya, or the West African province of the Islamic State. I should also mention that it will come up in our conversation, the group Ansaru. Ansaru is a faction of Boko Haram that we'll discuss, and their name in long form in Arabic is Ansar al-Muslimin fi Biladis Sudan, which means the supporters of the Muslims in Black Africa. Sudan referring to Africa in that context. So, but that group is often called Ansaru in common media parlance.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a good transition, because the next thing I wanted to ask you, which might play into how Ansaru relates to we like Garbi Frikia and others is based on the research you've done over the years, as well as a lot of field work you've done in West Africa and the Sahel. What are the foreign connections that you've seen with Boko Haram over the years, and how has it evolved up until it began to sort of have this romance with the Islamic State and then officially link up to it?
Well, I think the faction Ansaru that I just mentioned is the key faction to focus on if one is looking at international terrorism. And I can refer you to the U.S. specially designated terrorists, Khaled al-Barnawi and Adam Kumbar. Now, when Boko Haram was an above-ground preaching group from 2002 to 2009, they were already interacting with AQIM. And Khaled al-Barnawi's job, he was a friend of the founder, Muhammad Yusuf, was to link Yusuf's followers to military training with what was then the GSPC, Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, or Group Salafist, the GSPC. I won't use the French acronym. So Khaled al-Barnawi was taking Yusuf's followers up to Algeria for militant training in the hopes that he would then send these followers back to Yusuf, and then Yusuf would sort of have a political wing and a military wing. There was also Adam Kumbar, who's a U.S. specially designated terrorist that was based in northern Mali, and he was also facilitating Nigerians training with AQIM, the GSPC becoming AQIM in 2007. Now, Barnawi was very well connected to Mokhtar Belmokhtar. They were kidnapping together, connect Abu Zayed, southern commander of AQIM, very well connected to the people who ended up founding Mujao in Mali in 2012, 2013, 2014, guys like Omar Weld-Maha, Hamadou Keru, and so forth. So they were very much Saheli militants who happened to be Nigerian. Now, in 2011, Mujao and Ansaru both set up their enterprises in Mali and Nigeria, respectively.
Mujao being a splinter of AQIM.
Right. Mujao essentially being the more Mauritanian, Malian, Senegalese branch of AQIM that no longer was very close to the AQIM center due to their sub-Saharan African roots and differences with the Andalusian ideology of AQIM. As we've seen over the years, including with the splits with ISIS, as AQIM has shifted south, it's tended to lose control of its branches. So Mujao, the Movement for Unity and Jihad in West Africa, was essentially the Malian branch, and they ended up gaining some autonomy from AQIM. Ansaru was even further south in Nigeria, and they had a lot more autonomy from AQIM. And they came and started operating in Nigeria in 2011 with kidnapping about 11 foreigners over the course of 2011 to 2013, as well as ambushing Nigerian troops who were going to be deployed to Mali, and also doing a prison break or two. Their ideology was much more West African in mind than was AQIM's. And at first they had some disagreements with Shekau over leadership issues. Again, Barnawi was close to Yusuf. Yusuf was killed and then Shekau became leader. There was some sort of friction about how they could integrate their ranks. And eventually, however, Barnawi and Shekau came to some agreements after Ansaru got basically eradicated from Northwest Nigeria, in part by successful counterterrorism operations, in part by Shekau going after defectors to Ansaru, and in part because the intervention led by France and Mali cut off Ansaru's connection to its AQIM patrons. So what leads us to the ISIS, which we discussed in more detail in a moment, is that essentially Barnawi's men returned to northeast Nigeria, where Shekau was based, Borno and the border region of Cameroon, and began instituting kidnap operations, including 21 foreigners taken over the course of 2013-2014, getting millions of dollars, getting lots of prisoners released. And that sort of terrorism economy empowered, if you could use that word, some types of mafioso businessmen in the Nigeria-Cameroon border region who have then used this industry to traffic arms into Nigeria. They're basically benefiting from the insurgency. And this linkage between what used to be Ansaru and what is Shekau's faction, which has become more Tekfiri than Yusuf's, is sort of the alliance that has led us to ISIS today.
So can you talk a little bit about then what was the process that led Jamaat Ahl Sunnah Lidawa Wal Jihad to pledge bayat to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and then become Wayat Gharbi Fikriya of the Islamic State?
Absolutely. There's some things that are more easy to see and some things that are less easy to see. But as this podcast focuses a lot on primary sources, I'll try to cite primary sources as much as I can. But I just want to cite one background analytical point, and you can feel free to amend what I'm saying. But one trend that we've seen throughout North Africa is a lot of former AQIM linked groups or pro-AQIM groups or even AQIM factions have over the past year and a half shifted their loyalty to the Islamic State. Even if some of the leaders of these factions are still pro-AQIM, foot soldiers are shifting to Islamic State. Now, that's sort of what I think happened with Ansaru from an analytical perspective. It, like these foot soldiers and other formerly pro-AQIM groups, have also shifted their loyalty to Islamic State. And they basically followed that trend. So I think the key primary source point starts with the Tunisia-based media organization called Afrika Media, or Ifriqiya Al-Ilam, which issues media statements on behalf of all jihadist groups in Africa and claims to be nonpartisan, though I do believe it tends to have a pro-Islamic State affinity. Now, this group, Afrika Media, in early 2015, and by the way, they have a record for legitimacy or having insider sources, so they're not just issuing fake statements. For example, they have previewed attacks that have later occurred in North Africa, which shows some insider knowledge, which adds to their legitimacy. And Abu Malik Shaiba al-Hamad, a key Islamic State operative, has also endorsed Afrika Media. And therefore, what they say can often be regarded with a greater level of accuracy than just say, a typical person who's tweeting. Now, Afrika Media in early 2015 released a series of what it called consultations from the Shura or leadership of Jamaat Ahli Sunnah Dawati Wal Jihad, which talked about the reports coming from Jamaat Ahli Sunnah Dawati Wal Jihad from the so-called caliphate that Shekau declared in northeastern Nigeria in 2014. And according to these consultations, Jamaat Ahli Sunnah Dawati Wal Jihad was debating whether to pledge to Islamic State, and they told Afrika Media, we'll come back to you soon. Later, after Shekau made the pledge to Islamic State in March 2015, Afrika Media issued a report saying, we are the ones who linked up with Jamaat Ahli Sunnah Dawati Jihad, and we set them up with a Twitter account, and it was through the Twitter account that we set up that they ended up making the pledge. And they needed the Twitter account because Shekau was having a lot of trouble using YouTube and Agence France-Presse, the French media organization, to issue his videos because either YouTube was blocking them or AFP was only doing like 1 minute clips of what was otherwise a 30 minute video. So Afrika Media said, we liked Shekau. We liked his messaging. We liked how he stood up for the Chibok kidnapping. We like his manhaj. And we think that he just needed support reaching a more international audience, especially among the jihadist community. And that's why they connected with him. And they likely did it, in my view, through this Barnawi network that I was talking about, because some people in Afrika Media are likely connected to former AQIM or even current AQIM networks. And Barnawi's network was also connected to its former AQIM networks. So I suggest that the segue was in that regard.
There are also a number of Tunisians who are in northern Mali as well when AQIM was in charge. So it's possible that there are links through that as well.
That's right. And of course, Mujaw has had one of the leaders, al-Sahrawi, pledge to Islamic State. And Mujaw was like a cousin of what was Ansaru. And therefore, you know, if Mujaw was, and Afrika Media also said that they set up that faction of al-Murabitun, the Mujaw faction of al-Murabitun, with the pledge to Islamic State. And so I can sort of sense, you're right, this sort of Tunisian, Malian to Nigerian network all sort of shifted their loyalties to Islamic State. But Aaron, if I have a minute or two more on this topic, I would get a little bit deeper into this Twitter account that was set up.
Yeah, of course. Go for it.
This Twitter account was called Al-Urwa Al-Wutka, which is the name of of a verse, part of the Quran. And the Twitter account was set up in mid-January 2015. It was a total first for Boko Haram or Jamaat Tahrir Sunni Dawati Wal Jihad, because before they had issued, you know, YouTube videos or other types of videos, but they had no formal presence on the Twitter platform like most other Islamic State factions or affiliates have been having. And that was set up in January 2015. Now, before that, for at least half a year, Shekau had been announcing his support for al-Baghdadi. The videos with Shekau had the Islamic State signature nasheeds in them. Jamaat Tahrir Sunni Dawati Wal Jihad had been using the Islamic State black and white flag, and it had been copying Islamic State videos in its own Jamaat Tahrir Sunni Dawati Wal Jihad videos, including convoys of cars, like what we saw from Darna, Libya, including shooting people in the head and throwing them off a bridge into a bloody river, like Islamic State has shown from Iraq and Syria, and including a lot of scenes that are very typical of Islamic State. So there was already an impression that Boko Haram, as we called it, was shifting towards ISIS. And in addition to that, starting with these videos that appeared to be copying Islamic State, Boko Haram's leader Shekau had also declared a caliphate, or rather a Muslim state, in northeastern Nigeria. So that sort of concept of occupying territory, which Boko Haram started to do in mid-2014, all suggested an operational and media shift towards the Islamic State style. Now, the Twitter account ended up posting videos that were almost exactly the same as Islamic State in terms of the camera angles, in terms of the music, the way that they beheaded people, the way that they used a bird's eye view to show the city of Maiduguri, where Boko Haram has been based, in this way that Islamic State has done of Aleppo, Syria, for example. So it almost seemed like the videos were so close from Jamaat Tahrir Sunni Dawati Wal Jihad and Islamic State that they had to be closely choreographed. And then that's probably exactly what happened. And on Shaiba al-Hamad, this key Islamic State media operative, he basically was previewing the Jamaat Tahrir Sunni Dawati Wal Jihad videos, meaning he knew about them before they were even released on this Twitter account. So there was definitely close coordination going on. On March 7th, Shekau made the formal pledge to al-Baghdadi using the same script that other affiliates have done to al-Baghdadi. On March 12th, al-Baghdadi's spokesman formally accepted it. And what's interesting is that 10 other Islamic State affiliates from Algeria, Yemen, Libya, Syria, and Iraq, and the so-called Euphrates province in between the two, Syria and Iraq, all issued post-pledge praises of Shekau for doing that, which is very rare. There hasn't been so many post-pledge celebrations for any other group but what was Boko Haram. In any event, Boko Haram has since become Wilaya West Africa, Wilaya Garb Afrika, and its media has been a little bit silent since the March pledge, possibly because some members of its media were killed in a Nigerian offensive afterwards. But nonetheless, some media continues to come out, including the one yesterday, of up to 600 to 700 people praying in a Wilaya West Africa-led sermon, ostensibly from the Sambisa Forest in northeastern Nigeria for Ramadan.
Great. Thanks for sort of laying that out there for those who are listening to the podcast. Since the pledge was accepted, there's sort of been interesting dynamics going on in Nigeria itself. It seemed that they were starting to get pushed back by the coalition that had been created in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. But more recently, it seems that they're once again on the offensive also. Could you talk a little bit about sort of what they've been up to in the past few months or so in Nigeria by itself?
As you noted, there's been a regional military offensive against what we can call now Wilaya West Africa. And that began notably about at the exact same time that Shekau was making the pledge to Baghdadi on March 7th. It began actually around February 7th, the military offensive. And it was not actually because of this upcoming pledge. It was because Nigerian elections were scheduled to be held on February 14th, and they needed to distribute voter cards and clear Boko Haram out of those areas. as well as distribute voter cards in general around the entire country. So elections were postponed and coincided with the military offensive. So the idea, however, that Shekau's pledge to Baghdadi was done in a all of a sudden hurry because they were facing setbacks because of the military offensive is probably not true. Because as I mentioned a moment ago, this whole pledge process, the announcement of support for Baghdadi, the announcement of the caliphate, the copying of videos, began all the way in mid-2014 before any hint of a military offensive was going to happen. So I think Shekau's pledge was unrelated to the military offensive. Nonetheless, it was likely affected by the military offensive because the military offensive meant that Nigeria, as well as Chad and Niger, were going to team up in Borno State on Nigerian territory and drive Boko Haram out of its bases. And that largely happened. But Boko Haram, or Wilaya West Africa, historically has had a tactic to sort of lay low after facing large-scale military pressure. And it seems that's what Wilaya West Africa probably has done for the past 3 or 4 months. Lay low, retreat to the borderlands, go into its deeper bases, and wait for the offensive levels to shift back to regular levels, and then, you know, return to carrying out attacks. So we have seen actually Wilaya West Africa spread out attacks among a greater part of Nigeria than before the offensive to places like Kano and Plateau State and Kaduna. And that's likely to force the security forces to stop being condensed in the main area of Wilaya West Africa in Borno State and to shift its resources around the country. And we've seen Wilaya West Africa promise revenge on countries like Niger, Cameroon, and Chad for supporting this military offensive. And that's where I think things get really interesting with the relationship with the Islamic State, because as I mentioned, African media had some role in this Twitter account that was set up by Jamaat Tahrir al-Dawah al-Jihad before their pledge. And what's interesting is some of these warnings that Jamaat Tahrir al-Dawah al-Jihad issued seem to have been done in coordination with African media, because they began using a different logo for their group, for Jamaat Tahrir al-Dawah al-Jihad, on their Twitter account when they threatened Chad and Niger. And that logo has only been used by African media when African media has issued statements about Jamaat Tahrir al-Dawah al-Jihad. And it was those statements with that new logo that promised attacks on Chad and Cameroon. And the next day, those attacks happened with a double female suicide bombing in Niger and later an attack on Chad and Lake Chad. The more recent attacks in Chad have been claimed by more Islamic State too, the ones that happened last week. So it suggests to me that Islamic State may have played a role in encouraging Jamaat Tahrir al-Dawah al-Jihad to expand its attacks to Niger and Chad, especially as the pledge was about to happen and the regional military offensive was happening, because Islamic State was soon going to rename them as sort of the West African province. So there was no need for them to stick to their original Nigeria-focused insurgency.
Even though they've been stepping up attacks recently and outside of Nigeria, as we've seen in the last few weeks, can you talk a little bit about sort of what Boko Haram has done in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon previously, since they had been operating in some of these countries going back a few years, I believe. So could you tease that a little bit out, since it's clear that they while these attacks are new, the networks that probably are supporting them have some history to them.
That's absolutely right. And I think since at least since the start of the insurgency, even 2010, Boko Haram, then what we called Boko Haram, was deeply embedded into border region communities in Chad, in Cameroon, and Niger. But I think Boko Haram was more strategic than some people may assume. And I think Boko Haram knew that as long as they didn't carry out many attacks in the border region, as long as they didn't disturb the authorities in the border region, they could have a live and let live relationship with Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. So Boko Haram members could carry out attacks in Nigeria and go to Niger and lay low, recover, rest, recruit, and then come back to Nigeria. There's only a river separating Borno State and Niger. Same with Cameroon and Chad. Cameroon and Chad have had huge logistics networks of weapons, especially coming after the Libyan civil war when tons of Gaddafi's arms started passing through the Sahel region, but also because of arms available from the Darfur conflict, as well as arms that may be sold from Chad's own coffers by corrupt officials. And these arms come largely through Chad to Cameroon to Nigeria, and they get stored in border region cities. And while, yes, Boko Haram has historically pilfered arms from military barracks that it has raided, though there is a limited supply only in Nigeria. But so long as they can keep getting renewed supplies coming in from the Cameroonian border, they were able to launch this major insurgency in Nigeria. And I think it's those adding Cameroonian trafficking networks of weapons, and later their involvement in kidnapping operations and other illicit activities to raise money from Boko Haram, has really been the reason why Boko Haram has been an insurgency that has gone to higher levels of power than people could have originally thought. However, attacks really only began happening in Cameroon in 2013, when Cameroon started to interfere with these pipelines of weapons. And only did attacks begin happening consistently in 2014 with Niger, when Niger started to become concerned about Boko Haram literally controlling towns on the border with Niger. And Niger tried to crack down, and then Boko Haram retaliated. And Chad retaliated, intervened in Boko Haram's affairs even later, early 2015. And the retaliation by Boko Haram, as per its warnings, or Wilaya West Africa, has expectedly occurred. And that's why in the past month you saw suicide bombings at the police academy and police headquarters in Chad, another man in Burka, a suicide bombing in a market in Chad, as well as the killing of several Chad security officers. They tried to raid a logistics cell of Wilaya West Africa in Jamina. So basically, Wilaya West Africa has lived up to its threats, saying if you intervene in our affairs, we will intervene in yours. And that's why this has taken a much more sub-regional tone in the past 2 months or so.
With that said, and everything that's going on now, in terms of looking forward, then, what are some of the key questions or observations you're looking at to see where this might go in the coming months or half year or year, to better understand this movement and where it's going?
I think one of the things to look at will be the vision that Islamic State has for this new West Africa province, because the roots of West Africa province are still grounded in Nigeria. But yet I think that Islamic State wants this West Africa province to take on a more regional tone, including places like Mali even. And the question is, will West Africa province, although I think it's pretty clear that it will be able to move around the Lake Chad region, Niger, Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria, will it be able to play this role as the sort of genuine movement that is operational in all of West Africa? And that would include places like, say, Senegal, Mali, Ivory Coast, and so forth, Burkina Faso. And I think that will depend on the extent to which the faction of Mujao that broke from Omar Abitun, whether they can link up operationally with West Africa province, because that group of Mujao, they're already operational in Mali and Senegal and near the Ivorian border and so forth. So if they can really combine forces with West Africa province and all operate under the umbrella of West Africa province, then the power that this West Africa province can project in terms of the ability to carry out attacks in an entire region will be enhanced. And that's what I think Islamic State wants. And that's also why I think Islamic State has not responded to Mujao's pledge of allegiance to Baghdadi, probably because it wants Mujao to start working with West African province. Whether that can happen, likely rely on some of these leadership dynamics between people like al-Banawi, who I said used to be with AQIM, and people like al-Sahrawi or Hamad Keru, who are the pro-Islamic State Mujao leaders, and whether they can really integrate their ranks.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on to the show. I really appreciate it. And I think the listeners will have a better appreciation and understanding of what's been going on with Wilayat Gharbi Afrikiya and the affairs of West Africa more generally related to jihadism now.
Thanks a lot, Aaron, and appreciate you having me on. It's always interesting to have discussions with you. And for your global focus on this issue where the Islamic State is often seen as sort of a Syrian, Iraq, Middle Eastern thing, but the ripple effects are also being seen in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I know that was your other recent podcast. It's also influence in other ways in Southeast Asia. And probably the largest influence of the Islamic State beyond its sort of core Middle Eastern area of operations is West Africa. So it's important to track the trajectory in this region because it might also give some hints about what the Islamic State modus operandi will be when it tries to focus on other regions of the world, such as Central Asia or Southeast Asia.
Definitely. We'll see what happens next. Thanks again.
This episode's hashtag social media segment covers releases between July 28th and August 3rd.
During that time period, we saw 9 foreign fighters officially announced killed in Syria among a number of different groups.
On July 28th, Dr. Abdullah bin Muhammad al-Muhaisini started Jihad bin Malik's 7th fundraising campaign for support of Jaish al-Fatah in al-Zabadani, Syria.
On the same day, Wilayat Aden of the Islamic State does a tour of its alleged medical center in Yemen.
On the 29th, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State shows an examination at a dental clinic in al-Raqqa City.
The next day, on the 30th, a Libyan foreign fighter was announced dead in a suicide operation, Wilayat al-Furat of the Islamic State in western Haditha City in Iraq.
Also on the 30th, Dr. Abdullah bin Muhammad al-Muhaisini's Merkaz Duat al-Jihad opens the Ibn Taymiyyah Library in Idlib, Syria.
On the same day, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State opens a new media point in al-Kairouan district.
On July 31st, AQAP implements the Hudud penalty in al-Mukalla, Yemen, upon those who drank alcohol and took drugs.
On August 1st, Ibn Taymiyyah Media's Jahizuna fundraising campaign for jihad in Gaza is asking people to donate anywhere from $2,500 to $5,500 for different types of rifles, sniper rifles, and RPGs.
Also on the 1st, Al-Shabaab in Somalia did special prayers honoring the death of Mullah Omar.
On August 1st as well, Wilayat Tarablis of the Islamic State gives a tour of the marble factory in Sirte, Libya.
Also on August the 1st, Ahrar al-Sham's services office put out 2 job ads looking for people to work in relief, police, transportation, medical, public relations, contracts, licenses, notary, cleaning, engineers, telecommunications, machinery, and IT.
On August 1st, Wilayat al-Barakah of the Islamic State shows off its cleaning office that cleans the streets and collects the trash.
And on August 1st as well, the Al-Mujadama clan, based in Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State, pledges bayah to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
The last one on August 1st is from Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State, where it arrests a person who does underground tattoo work.
On August the 2nd, the Islamic State creates an app for Android devices that publishes all of its official releases.
Also on the 2nd, Wilayat Khorasan of the Islamic State opens the Hakimullah Masood military training camp in an unnamed location in the AFPAC region.
If you have any feedback, you can email podcast@jihadology.net. And you can also find us on Twitter, where we are @JihadPod. If you're a fan of the show, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast in iTunes, and also spread the word so we can get more listeners.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Jacob for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly, and to Elsbeth Carruthers for helping with background research on the primary source material. Until next time, I'm out.